We don't know whether we are being heard on spaceships circling the Earth. We don't know whether this radio signal, by some kind of advanced technology that we don't understand, has been magnified and speeded so that it is now going faster than the speed of light and is reaching perhaps the Andromedan galaxy. But we do know that there are many ordinary folks, or maybe not quite so ordinary, who have had the experience of being abducted by alien creatures, most of them also then transported to a spaceship where they've been in further commerce with those alien creatures, sometimes involving close examination of their bodies and of their inner organ systems. There are many people who believe that sort of thing, and Susan Clancy, a psychologist at Harvard, has been studying some such people, a representative sample, and she's with us tonight. We'll be joined a little bit later by an old friend, Paul Kurtz, the founder and chairman of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. Susan, good evening.
Good evening.
How many people are out there right now, say within the general American population, who are pretty well convinced that they've had this alien abduction experience?
Well, I can't actually answer that data because we don't have good, national sample data on what percent of the population believes they've been abducted by aliens. Suffice it to say, it's more than you think. That's the best I can say. I know that over half of the population believes it is possible that people are being abducted by aliens, but actually no data exists as to what percent of the population believes this.
I entered on Google earlier this afternoon the title of your new book, Abducted: How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens. Your name, Susan Clancy, and the simple word review. And I Googled. And of course, there were many, many pages. And I found many sites, sort of UFO sites and parapsychological sites and things of that sort, which reviewed your book with some in high dudgeon or low contempt. And there were many quick messages from habitués of those sites condemning your book and condemning you and condemning all who call into question this experience, which is universally acknowledged because so many hundreds, thousands, perhaps millions have had it by now.
That's exactly right. It's very damaging to my self-esteem. There are a lot of angry people out
And
there right
what if the aliens are watching you and
now.
in conference this very night trying to decide what to do about this doubting Harvard person?
Look, if they'd abduct me, no one would be happier than me.
It would give you a new lease, give you a new view of
Yeah, I think
the
I could write
phenomenon.
a best-selling book.
Yeah.
I think right there, that would be a screenplay.
This book that of yours, which I've been reading with great fascination, was is based upon doctoral research you did at Harvard. Is that right?
Well, doctoral and postdoctoral research, yes.
How did you come to it?
How did I come to study aliens? That's a really good question,
Indeed, I
Jay.
know that a prior stage was studying people who had memory, false or otherwise, of sexual abuse.
Yes. I mean, actually, I was just interested in false memory creation in general. I wanted to know more about how people come to create false memories and what type of people are particularly prone to creating false mechanisms, etc. At the time, the way people were studying it, or a group that was interesting, was people who had recovered memories in psychotherapy. People had recovered memories often of sexual abuse or perhaps of multiple personalities or past lives. So initially, I started studying people had recovered memories of sexual abuse. One hypothesis was that these were false memories. But as you can imagine, that's a very controversial topic, very politicized. I was not particularly popular. People thought I was questioning the existence of sexual abuse. So I thought alien abduction would be sort of a less
It would
politicized.
be safer.
Yes, I think I was wrong about that, to
I
tell
think
you the
so
truth.
too.
Yeah.
One has to come. There are many, many things worth discussing here. You know that I'm a psychologist, as you are.
Yes.
One thing that I think, one group who are much to be blamed for this fad, this social panic over alien abduction, just as they are to be blamed for the earlier social panic over sexual abuses that never happened, a group to be blamed is our group. That is to say, the profession of psychology, particularly many in clinical psychological practice who simply have been over-Freudian and totally uncritical of Freudian theory and have reified the concept of repression and of
Right.
repressed memory so that they just take it as doctrinaire and not requiring any further skeptical examination.
Yeah.
I have for a long time been following particularly the literature and some of the researchers in the area of false memory of sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. Indeed, Elizabeth Loftus, upon whom you draw, as an old friend of mine, she's been on this program a number of times. Why is our own profession so complicit in all of this?
Oh, that is a tough question to answer.
Including, I should add, one a prominent psychiatrist at your institution, Harvard, who died unhappily in an accident only last year, but John Mack, who wrote, won a Pulitzer Prize for something else,
right,
wrote a book then, some years later, in which he absolutely proclaimed the reality of alien abduction.
Yes, he really wasn't. I'm not sure he was a big advocate of repression. I don't know about that, but he certainly believed in the literal accuracy of his patients' accounts under hypnosis.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if anything, he should have been critical of hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of repression, I mean, that's a question I ask myself. It's not just psychologists who seem to accept it, swallow it wholeheartedly. I think in the general population, people just like the idea. It just seems to make sense to everybody that the mind banishes traumatic memories into the unconscious. I don't really know why. I mean, if anything, when traumatic things happen, I think most of us remember them all too well. So I don't know why this idea is so prevalent in society.
Well, it's part of the Freudianization of Western society. Freud laid all of this out about 100 years ago, began to lay it out over 100 years ago. And he was his own best publicist. He was a master of building his own reputation, building his own movement, building his own institutions. And as we know, the general critique of Freud, which develops a little bit later, is that most of his propositions are unfalsifiable. You can't really test them.
Yes, that's
so
correct.
It becomes a matter of faith, and faith reified by constant repetition and reinforcement from other psychoanalysts, and then from your patients to whom you sell the same set of concepts, including, yes, of course, the concept of repression.
That's right.
Let us come directly to the phenomenon of alien abduction. Where do we have the first reports of the modern form of that fantasy?
Well, that's a good question. I think the mom and pop of the alien abduction story were Betty and Barney Hill.
Yeah.
And that was in the 60s.
In New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire. And what happened is, they first saw something in the sky in 1961, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't sure what it was, but something happened when they were driving late at night, and Betty in particular felt that there was some time afterwards she couldn't account for. And Betty had read a number of things about UFOs and the existence of aliens and had watched movies about aliens, etc. And she was predisposed to interpret her experiences perhaps being alien abduction related. However, they had no full-blown memories of being abducted by aliens
until
they underwent hypnosis sessions,
exactly,
with a Boston psychiatrist in 1966, I believe it was. So it was about 5 years later that they then recovered memories under hypnosis of what they believe happened to them.
At the same time that happened to them, I was an assistant professor at Yale University,
uh-huh,
doing some research on attitude change, and doing it in a very dramatic way, changing people's attitudes through hypnosis.
I did not know this.
Well, okay, you'll find it in the literature. Telling them that they would have amnesia for the suggestion that their affect on some important matter would be altered until later on when a signal was given which would remove the amnesia. We were looking, this was actually in relation to a general line in attitude theory, which you may have heard of, consistency theory.
Yes.
And we were trying to check out that if you alter the affect, you will get spontaneous reorganization of the cognitions about the object of affect. If you tell somebody you're going to really dislike the idea of America giving aid to foreign nations, when you wake up, you'll have an extreme aversion to the idea of America helping other nations financially, but you won't remember having been told this. That's the nature of the pattern with these hypnotizable subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And then we test them for their beliefs about the consequences of America giving aid to foreign nations, and those turn out to be very negative. One would think that that's sort of a game you're playing, and certain theories of hypnosis would suggest that. But we had subjects, and we let it go in one of the experiments for some 2 weeks before we removed the amnesia. When we removed the amnesia one day for one particular guy, a very charming young man who was a medical student at Yale University and was an African, and told him about it, he laughed. And he said, "Now I understand what I did up at Storrs," Storrs being the location of the University of Connecticut. And I asked him, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I was invited to participate in a panel discussion at the University of Connecticut on their UN Day. I and some other Africans, we were supposed to discuss the future of Africa. And the main thing I said in my speech was that what Africa doesn't need is aid from the United States. That's ruinous for us, and it's bad for the United States. Cut it out. Which startled and scared me, frankly, because what it said was that this kind of hypnotic suggestion, in fact, is enacted not just in a kind of a role play with a common understanding between the hypnotist and the subject, but can have real life consequences.
That's exactly right.
And what you found is real life consequences when hypnotists using what they take to be a neutral technique to investigate the experiences of their subjects, in fact, are implanting those very same experiences, aren't they?
Yes, it can be potentially very, very dangerous. Yes, I agree. And it's all under the guise of helping the subject, which I find very ironic. So,
when we did that research and found that was so potent a technique, we stopped and I never did another such study.
I was going to say, they probably had different human subjects' approval they had to go through before you did this research back then. Huh?
This was back in 61 or thereabouts, and they didn't have all of those techniques from the APA Ethics Committee. You're quite right. I think we did it ethically, but still. But the point is, I mentioned it only, and I told the story in a rather long-winded way, because it points up the potency of hypnotic and other such suggestion techniques by which subjects can be led. We were leading with a conscious intent to lead, but lots of therapists who share the same quasi-delusional system with their subjects can be leading without their fully understanding what they're doing.
Yes, without either the therapist fully understanding or the person in therapy under hypnosis. And and often what's so interesting is the therapist is convinced that what is emerging during psychotherapy is accurate and real because the subject believes it so much.
Sure.
And there's so much affect behind it, which sort of reifies the whole experience. So
we're going to be stopping every so often for commercials. And after a batch of them that is coming right now, we're going to be joined, if all goes according to plan, by an old friend, Paul Kurtz. Do you know the work of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation?
Yes,
of Claims
a little
of the Paranormal?
Bit. Yes, yes.
Paul is the founder and chairman. I'm on their board, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
And we'll bring Paul in on this, who will know something about the phenomenology. We'll know something about the spread of this phenomenon.
Excellent.
We'll be directly back to Susan Clancy and, I think, Paul Kurtz after we pause for this. And I trust that we are joined now by Paul Kurtz. Paul, are you there? Hello, Paul.
Be with you again.
How are you, my boy?
Fine. Doing very good.
You're at home in Buffalo, are you?
Yes, I'm in Buffalo, and this is, I think, the first time we've been on the telephone. Usually I'm in your studio.
Yes, indeed. But I'm very glad you're there. You've been looking at the book by Susan Clancy, I guess.
Yes, I have indeed.
Susan, meet Paul Kurtz.
Hi, Paul Kurtz.
Good evening.
How are you?
I must say I enjoyed your book. Oh. It reviewed so many experiences and that we've had over the last 20, 30, 40 years about the UFO saga.
Among the 40 books that Paul Kurtz has authored, one, and of this I think he is the senior editor, others, it's kind of an anthology, is titled Challenges to the Enlightenment in Defense of Reason and Science.
Ah, yes.
I would say, Paul, that reports of alien abduction is one way of questioning, challenging, possibly assaulting the scientific method and scientific reasonableness.
Well, perhaps it's an expression of this fantasy-prone civilization we live in that Ms. Clancy talks about in her book. And I think maybe films and television, the Internet, all contribute to that. So it's imagination gone wild, in one sense. And I think your interpretation is right on.
And we want to develop more on that interpretation shortly. But Paul, first, can you fill us in on the question of the scope, the extent of this phenomenon?
It may be perennial to the human condition.
Yeah.
I mean, we do. We live in the world. We look up at the skies. We wonder, who are we? What is the meaning of life? And now in this modern world, with all of these great inventions and devices, people are looking into space. We've discovered over 135 planets. And so the question is there life in outer space? Probably, yes, there are billions and billions of planets. is there life, and do they visit us on Earth? That's a great question of the last 50, 60 years.
But these experiences of being visited by them on Earth, do you agree with Susan that probably the first significant instance of that particular modern myth is the Barney and Betty Hill case back in the early 60s in New Hampshire?
1961 in New Hampshire. That is the most popular rendition.
But it spread very like wildfire, didn't it?
It did, and people heard about it. It's in the milieu. And so instead of finding angels out there visiting us, we find UFOs, chariots of the gods coming to Earth and abducting people. That's very exciting. It's part of science fiction. But the interesting thing is that so many millions and millions of people believe it. That's what she describes in her interesting
and
book.
And I'm wondering how many hundreds of thousands or millions of people, we have no way of estimating this directly, have had that experience or believe that they've been through this very kind of confrontation with aliens who've come to visit, usually in the dark of the bedroom.
Yes, well, people have strange experiences. They've seen strange lights. They suddenly feel paralyzed in bed, and then they wonder, oh, am I being abducted? And so the fact that other people believe the same thing, they accept very, very clearly. So this is a kind of new faith. I think it's a religious phenomenon in one sense.
It's much reinforced, of course, by what's in the popular media.
Yes, it's the media colors the interpretation. It's in the eye of the beholder. So now the question is, are we being visited by creatures from outer space? Well, we can find no hard evidence for that. And the Enlightenment says, if you have a belief, see if you can support it by some kind of evidence. So there's no hard evidence about that. And if that's the case, why do so many people believe this? Why is there this leap of faith? And I think Ms. Clancy gives several interesting accounts or explanations.
Well, we now want to come to that directly. Susan, let's talk about the research investigation that you did. Once you located some, your total sample was around 50, was it?
Well, I mean, it depends on what study you're talking about.
Well, I'm talking about...
You know what? Can I just say one thing?
Well, sure.
Something you both were talking about, I want to say I've been wrestling with. And the question of why do so many people believe these accounts? And something I'm beginning to realize, and I don't have any way to convey it to the audience that I'm speaking with when I'm on radio or TV, but I think most people don't understand what constitutes evidence for something. For most people, what other people say, if those people sound sane, is reasonable. So today on National Public Radio, I got attacked by an abduction researcher telling me, it was awful, that I don't know what I'm talking about, and for 50 years he's been studying these reports.
Who was he?
And these people, oh my God, can I say it?
Well, yeah. I'm sure
it was completely traumatic for me. It was Dave Jacobs from Temple.
I've read about him. I haven't
He's
him.
One of the exponents of this UFO faith. He's a true believer. It's very
He
very
is
clear.
A true believer, and the problem is, for him, what constitutes scientific evidence is either he doesn't know or it's not important, and I think that's just generally in the population.
Am I right that to our continuing shame of the matter I was adverting to earlier, he is also a psychologist?
He's a historian at Temple University.
Oh, he's a historian. That's
an associate professor.
That's a relief. I thought it was the other.
You know, one point, you hear all these accounts, you meet people who claim it, and then it's difficult to know what's true and what's false. So the real crisis in America today is we're uncertain about the epistemological basis of knowledge.
That's exactly correct.
And how do you decide
it?
And there are there's hard data. There are practical reasons that you can give for being careful unless you can replicate it and objectively confirm it.
Right.
And that's very hard to convince people.
Let's look directly at the research, though.
Okay.
What did you do?
Okay, what did I do? Well, I started out very modestly, and I said, okay, I want to look at memory distortion in people who believe they were abducted by aliens. So I'm going to run an ad in the local papers. I'm going to look for people who think they were abducted, and then I'm going to run them through a couple of standardized laboratory memory tests that are looking at false memory creation in the lab. So that's what we did. So I put an ad in the paper. It said, have you been abducted by aliens? The phone ran off the hook for about a month. And I started interviewing people, and that was the start of about 6 years of research. What we did, the first thing I found out is that most people who believe they were abducted by aliens did not actually have memories. That was the most interesting thing for me. They just believed they were abducted on the basis of certain symptoms or experiences they had that were consistent with what they knew about alien abduction.
Yeah, they're reading into their experiences.
Exactly.
I mean, it's part of the geist or the spirit of the times. But, you know, I've been in this business over 30 or 40 years now, and there's so many claims. I mean, some people talk about past lives or future lives. There are ghosts and hauntings, out-of-body experiences.
Multiple personalities.
Vampires, ghouls, ghosts, and everything else. So this UFO phenomena is part of a whole syndrome of fantasy beliefs.
Yeah.
Yes, it's been going on for millennia, obviously. If you go to classical antiquity, you find dreams of a trip to the moon, for example, which are conveyed by some writers who seem to believe they've really been there.
Yes, but Milton, now we have something else. We do have a scientific method, and it is reliable, although fallible, and we have standards for judging what is true and what is false, and we make great progress when we apply it. Many people don't understand that method. That's the problem we face today.
Well, let me see. Let me take the opposing position. And obviously, I'm just role-playing. But I would say to both of you, well, now, wait a minute. How can you prove that these are not experiences based in reality? How can you prove that there have not been alien visitors who have chosen some humans, not either of you, obviously,
right,
and have abducted them to their own space vehicles and had some investigative involvement with them?
But what I would want to say is the burden of proof is not on me. I don't have to disprove it. It's on you making the
outrageous... I'm making the more extravagant claim.
Exactly. And that's the problem, is that people make these claims for which there exists no objective evidence, and then they turn to scientists and say, disprove it.
Well, we should turn to Paul.
I
must turn to you, Paul, as resident philosopher, and ask you to quickly explain the principle of Occam's razor.
Well, simplicity. You pick the simplest hypothesis. You don't confound them. But the point is, you need to corroborate a claim. You have to be very critical of eyewitness testimony. You need to know how to interpret it. So it's the replication, and it's the independent verification of a claim. Otherwise, anything goes. Any subjective experience is as true as any other.
Now, it is the fact that Susan, in her research, and she's done this with some other colleagues at Harvard, has found that these abductees believe their experiences. They are not faking. They are not just romancing naive interviewers. They, in fact, really are quite convinced they've had these experiences. The question then immediately arises, who are these people? Some of them are quite intelligent. Some of them are sort of personally attractive, or so Susan and her colleagues found them. The question is, who then are these people? Is there any way in which they can be demonstrated to be significantly different from those who don't have such experiences? And that is what your own research has pursued in recent years and is reported in the new book, Abducted, How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens. That is, I should have added instantly, just published by Harvard University Press. And when we return from some impending commercials, I want to get directly into what those research findings are, Susan.
Sure.
How these people differ from other people.
Okay.
We proceed directly with Susan Clancy and Paul Kurtz after this. We are talking about the alien abduction experience, about people who've had that experience. We're doing that tonight with Susan Clancy, who's got a new book investigating that very question, and with Paul Kurtz, a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of Buffalo, State University of New York at Buffalo, and founder and chairman of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, on whose advisory board I have served, I think, for some 10 or more years. And that's a matter of considerable pride for me, Paul.
Well, we're delighted you're there because you're a psychologist and you're intrigued by this phenomena, as I am.
But as we were saying, I think just before you joined us, and Susan agrees with me, some psychologists have really helped to spread this nonsense.
Yeah, this notion, the psychotherapist thought that if these things happen, we can put the person under hypnosis and really elicit what happened. But I think that turned to be false.
Yes, we talked about that. Yes. We talked about that a good deal just before you joined us today.
Yes.
Now, Susan, directly to the research, what then differentiates these people from those who do not have such experiences?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to address is when we're talking about these people, who are we talking about?
Good.
I mean, most people who believe they were abducted by aliens do not actually have memories of their abduction experiences. So as I mentioned earlier, I mean, these are just people that have had a number of unusual or upsetting symptoms or experiences, and they're trying to understand them. And for better or for worse, today being abducted by aliens is a culturally available way to understand why you feel the way you do. Now, those people I don't think are any different from any of us who are searching the shelves of Barnes and Nobles trying to buy books to understand why we feel the way we do. I mean, if you just look at these bookstores, you know, you have ADD or you have PTSD or you're not eating enough protein or you need to do more yoga. I mean, we're constantly searching for ways to understand how we feel, et cetera. So I don't think that makes people unusual, that they're looking for an explanation and they adopt alien abductions, because they're not saying they were for sure abducted. They just think, maybe I was abducted. Now, if we're talking about people who actually end up in a hypnotist's office or an abduction researcher's office and vividly remember their abduction experiences, mm-hmm. they do differ, most likely, from other people in that the data we collected suggests that they tend to be a little more fantasy prone than other people. They have very vivid imaginations. They appear to be more suggestible than the control subjects. In addition, they appear to endorse more unusual beliefs than average people do. Beliefs like numbers have special powers, or you know, past lives, et cetera, et cetera.
They sound like New Agers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
how can they avoid that? Given the look at the Hollywood films, Harry Potter, the best-selling book and film and so on, or Lord of the Rings. So we're surrounded, in one sense, by a fantasy-prone milieu, and so different people have different fantasies. And these are their pet fantasies. They were abducted, yes, and sexually abused, yes. And that, in one sense, that's entertainment. It's showbiz that has entered into the
country. But there is an extra factor in the analysis that Susan and her colleagues have come to, and that is that there is a particular kind of experience which provides the phenomenal base for elaboration in these directions, and that is the phenomenon of sleep paralysis.
Right.
Would you explain what that is?
Sure. Sleep paralysis is, from a medical perspective, what they'd say is that it's a non-pathological desynchrony in sleep cycles. Okay, so it's like a temporary blip in your sleep cycles whereby your body is still experiencing the paralysis that accompanies sleep naturally, and your mind is awake. So there's a brief moment, maybe 30 seconds to 2 minutes, where you can't move, but you're awake and you're aware you can't move. And this is very, very frightening for people that have the experience. And then couple that with the fact that sometimes when you have this experience, it's accompanied by hallucinations, like visual or auditory or perceptual hallucinations. And people say that while they can't move and they're terrified, they see sinister shadows in the room, or they feel a pressure on their chest, or as if they're levitating in the sky or falling through space. And it is a terrifying experience. It probably impacts about 30% of the population.
And it's an experience which begs an explanation.
Yes.
I think it explains some of these cases, hypnagogic and hypnopompic sleep, falling asleep and waking up in that dream state. People tend to believe these things. It doesn't account for all of the cases. I think what accounts for it is creative imagination, reading into the world what you want the world to be like, and thinking that you're special and your life has special meaning, and that the aliens have visited you and abducted you, and that gives comfort too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of, if you will, religious belief. It's similar to a mystical experience in one sense. So you need not have sleep paralysis. Many do have that, yes, and it explains it. But I think it's a leap to a new kind of faith, a new kind of religion, a space-age religion that is far more exciting than the old-time religion.
I gather, Susan, from looking at your book, that not only have you worked in William James Hall, that's where the Harvard Psychology Department is located,
right,
but that you've been very interested in William James, and particularly his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Is that right?
Yes, I mean,
it's a work that I teach once a year in a psychology of religion course, as a matter of fact.
And where are you teaching?
University of Chicago.
Oh, you're at the University of Chicago. I would like to take that class.
But in it, William James, a great psychologist, philosopher, and at the turn of the century, is much interested in mysticism, the mystical illuminative experience, and is quite convinced that that's, in a way, the font, the source of all real religious visionary excitement and of visionary content. And he wishes he could have it, but he can't. And he asks, what brings people to have that sudden, illuminating, pantheistic sense of superb optimism, enthusiasm, and the revelation of things never before seen or understood? Do you think there is a parallel between that classic mystical experience, the Unio Mystica, on the one hand, and these experiences on the other hand?
Yes.
You sound rather tempted.
I would reaffirm that, yes. And if William James was back today, I think he'd include this in his great work on the variety of religious experience. And, you know, out-of-body experiences are part of that. A large percentage, well, a significant percentage of people have out-of-body experiences. And this is also an additional explanation, not simply sleep paralysis, but an out-of-body experience where you think you're floating, and then you think you've been floated aboard a UFO. Yeah.
You know, just continuing on that, I think people misunderstand the sort of sleep paralysis hypothesis. I don't think any of us are suggesting that sleep paralysis explains the alien abduction experience. In fact, I don't think that's the case at all. The only thing interesting about sleep paralysis is it joins the litany of weird experiences that people have that they try and understand.
Yeah.
So you're talking about out-of-body experiences. Yes, a lot of people have out-of-body experiences and they want to understand why. Just as a lot of people have a sleep paralysis episode and they wake up and they say, that was pretty damn strange. I want to know what happened there.
Well, the point is unexpected neurological events occur.
Yes.
And they challenge the person to whom they've occurred to come up with some explanation. Well, and very often those explanations are provided, now they are provided, by all the mythology of alien abduction.
Well, isn't that true of near-death experiences as well?
I think it
many
is,
people
absolutely.
Report that at the moment of dying, or they think they're dying, then they come back and they've been to another realm. And here I think imagination is at work.
Actually, Paul, somebody who's been closely associated with PsyCup, and I know I've met her at some of the PsyCup meetings. Susan Blackmore,
yes.
Is that her name?
Yes, she's done a lot of research.
A British psychologist
that.
Has done research on that. Just tomorrow night, in fact, we are visiting with Mary Roach, the author of a new book titled Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife.
That's a great book.
You've read
yes,
that, have you?
Yes,
yeah.
It's wonderful.
So these anomalous experiences you're talking about, strange experiences, and how do you interpret them?
That's exactly right.
Well, you read into it, I think. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Right, and how I think often scientists forget that when you're trying to interpret something, you're limited in your interpretation by the explanations that you're actually aware of.
But
and
now,
for the average person, what are they aware of?
Yes, but the thing that puzzles me, John Mack, who also taught at Harvard,
right.
And had exam, and you mentioned him in your book.
Yeah.
We spoke about him earlier again, yeah. Paul, before you
Well, many
us.
Of these cases, I've debated him on at least two occasions. And how can a psychologist be, or a doctor in this case, psychiatrist, be convinced about these tales that he hears from people? He hears so many tales. Is it real? Is it hallucinatory? Is it genuine? He accepted these at face value.
Well, he accepted it because he said that to be in the presence of these people during the hypnosis sessions when they were recovering their harrowing memories was to be in the presence of a, quote, truth teller. So for John Mack, the power, the sort of emotional intensity of the memories being recovered was an indicator of the veracity of these memories,
you
which
found,
is too bad.
You actually did some physiological testing,
yes.
And you found that there is very intense physiological reaction.
The reason why I discount what John Mack tells us is because I've met so many other people, for example, past lives. I've met people who are convinced they were Civil War soldiers or they lived in the days of Cleopatra. So many accounts of tales that people have. I mean, it's really wide. If you want to open it up, you open it up to everything. So which are true and which are false?
I lived in the days of Napoleon. Did I ever tell you that? Well, I was a nonentity and a very rather stupid coward who ran away from battle.
That never happens.
That
Nobody
never
happens. Ever
exactly.
says that.
Well, you know, I've tried this in my classroom. I can't do it. And I said, let's go back to a previous life, and I would put students in a quiet state, and they would give any kind of
sure.
tale you can think of. So the imagination is at work here,
yeah.
too.
Now, I have a challenging comment to both of you, sort of a yes, but yes, of course you're right, and I welcome Susan's book. It confirms suspicions I've had for a long time. Of course, all of this is the case. But if people aren't persuaded that it is the case, and if they want to go on believing in alien abduction, if they want to go on believing in life after death, as to be sure that many of their religious beliefs require them to or help them to think, if in general they want to engage in parapsychological consolation, Paul,
yes, that's
why
true.
Should we be bothered by it?
Well, you know,
that helps people handle as they struggle through this veil of tears, so to speak.
It may be, but you know, you need some cognitive touch with reality. If you go too far afield, then where are you? I mean, take this case of communicating with the dead, which is widespread in American culture today. Are they really communicating with their Aunt Matilda? Is she really talking to them or not? So at some point, you need a reality check. And that's why you need to appeal to facts and evidence and hard reasons.
Well, there you're dealing as well, though, with religious tradition, which in the main asserts the persistence of individual identity beyond what we classify as death.
Yeah, so I would be a skeptic of this whole range of phenomena. It's interesting, but is it true?
I'd like to believe that has some plausibility to it, of course.
Yeah, but what you like to believe doesn't make it true. That's the point.
Unfortunately not. Listen, we've got to pause for just a moment, and we will return directly to Paul Kurtz and to Susan Clancy after these words. And we return to Susan Clancy and Paul Kurtz. Paul, I know you've got to leave us in a few minutes. I want to bring something back to your memory. It was probably about 10 or 11 years ago that we had a meeting of PSYCUP in Seattle.
Yeah.
And we presented at the major session, we presented an award to Carl Sagan.
Yes, indeed.
You asked me to make that presentation, which I did with great particular investment, he being an old friend. And the other person we honored on that occasion, I believe, was Elizabeth Loftus.
Yes. Yeah, both important figures.
And we mentioned Elizabeth early when Susan and I first started chatting tonight. Elizabeth has been through some very hard times. That is to say, she's done brilliant research. She's been rewarded by various professional organizations, but she's been also much attacked, condemned, and even sued one or two times. Can you explain why?
Well, she's been critical of repressed memory, and she shows that eyewitness testimony often fails, and for that, people are offended by what she said, and she's in a heavy suit in the state of California at the moment, and in fact, PSYCUP is party to that suit at the same time, so we're very disturbed. But you know, Milt, this is all a sign of that magical thinking is so deep in our culture, the transcendental temptation is at work. I think the best therapy for this is critical thinking. And I think that the reflective thought, trying to explain what you experience and find causes for it, that can be satisfying too. And I think our culture needs that.
The social panic that Elizabeth Loftus helped to stem was the panic of discoveries through recovery of repressed memory of childhood sexual abuse, usually by a man of his young daughter. Almost all of those instances turn out to be though believed by the accusing daughter, turn out to be untrue and usually cultivated in those women who are now into early middle age by so-called therapists who hypnotize them and plant those ideas.
And that was a tragic misuse of repressed memory, and
exactly.
Many people have suffered from that, and she was able to expose that and say, be cautious, and I think that was very important. Try to find the causes of behavior and not simply assume that these things happened in the past.
But where does the resistance and the continued pursuit of Elizabeth Loftus come from?
Well, I think there's a will to believe, and many people are tenacious in holding on to these beliefs, and maybe this is the impact of Freud, and they believe in repressed memory and sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And that happens in some cases, but I think Elizabeth Loftus has contributed enormously in clarifying that this is not happening in most cases.
Of course. Susan, have you been in touch with Elizabeth?
Yes, I have. Yeah. I admire her very much. She's one of my heroes.
What do you make of her current situation?
You know, I think to a certain extent, I've run into a little bit of the hostility, obviously to a much lesser extent than she has. And I've spent a lot of time trying to understand why, if you challenge repression, you elicit so much antipathy. And I have come to the conclusion that by challenging repression, people hear you say sexual abuse is not a big issue, or sexual abuse is not important. Somehow,
it's very important when it happens.
I know. Somehow, repression has become linked to childhood sexual abuse. And if you question repression, then you're questioning the existence of childhood sexual abuse, which I think is absolutely preposterous. Because if anything, the concept of repression has done a disservice to real childhood sexual abuse victims.
But you know, it's interesting. Alien abductions, according to some, is, and you can elicit it because it's repressed memory, and sexual abuse is the same thing. So that's a misuse of an important technique.
What?
And incidentally, Elizabeth Loftus, her case is going to be heard by the California Supreme Court. PsyCop is tied up in that suit because we published an article by her, and I think there's an unfair attack upon science. We need to defend the integrity of science.
Who are the attackers in that case?
Well, in this case, there's a woman by the name of Jane Doe, who claims that she had revealed her identity, which she did not. And if she prevails, this would be a terrible blow to the future scientific, free scientific inquiry.
Well, it's a struggle you've been engaged in for a lifetime.
Yeah. And it's ongoing.
And it never ends.
Yes, and we appreciate your role, Milt, as a defender of science and reason in our culture.
Yes, I agree with that.
And Paul, thank you very much for joining us, and my best to all. Is Andy Skolnick still
Isolate Worker? Yes, indeed. He's heading up the Committee for the Scientific Examination of Medicine.
Yeah, does wonderful work.
Thank you.
Give him my regards and all the other guys I know up there. And thank you so much for joining us
tonight. Thank you, and thank you, Susan Clancy.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you, Paul.
And Susan, we will be directly back. Okay. First, we need to pause only briefly for an update on the evening's news. And let's reintroduce our guest for the evening. Susan Clancy is in Boston. She's talking to us on an ISDN line. That's why it sounds as if she's in the studio. She is a postdoctoral fellow in psychology at Harvard University and the author of the new book, Abducted, How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens. And that is published by Harvard University Press. A few words about you, Susan. You're actually working in Nicaragua these days, are you?
Yes, I am. I'm on a two-year research fellowship in Nicaragua.
At what institution?
INCAI is the name of the institution. It's an educational and research institution in Central America that's dedicated towards helping out with kind of economic and political stability in the region.
Your training at Harvard, I know you've got a doctorate in psychology, mm-hmm. but in which division? Was it a clinical degree or?
No, it was called experimental psychopathology.
Uh-huh.
So it was actually research psychology.
Yeah. And there's some disagreement even within your department about this research, I gather.
Well, actually, in my department, I think there's not that much disagreement. I mean, some people in the department have suggested to me that I get out of this area because it's so politicized and I'm going to rule myself out of jobs in the future.
But don't you as well have some people who are still holding on to the pertinence of repression as an explanation for just about everything?
Actually, not the psychology department at Harvard. However, the psychiatry department at Harvard Medical School, for sure. And actually, most of the rest of the world still seems to be holding on to the concept of repression.
Well,
it's hard for me to understand why.
Have the psychiatry people still not begun to do a critical reevaluation of Freudianism or what?
You know what? The whole area is so complicated. I want to recommend a book. I want to recommend Rich McNally's book. It came out a few years ago. It's called Remembering Trauma.
Yeah.
It's published by Harvard University Press.
He is your colleague in this research, isn't he?
Yes. He was my advisor, and he's my current colleague and co-author on all sorts of papers. He just wrote an excellent book, which just covers exhaustively all of the research on memory and repression, and it's a compelling argument for the fact that repression just simply does not exist. However, I think the reason why it continues to linger on is because the truth is people do forget childhood sexual abuse experiences. The question is, do they forget it because they repressed it because it was so traumatic and it was banished into the unconscious? Or do they forget it because they were kids, they didn't know what was happening, and they simply didn't understand it until later on? So I think as long as people forget that they were abused as children, this concept of repression is going to continue to exist as an explanation for how they could possibly forget their abuse experiences.
There are so many major concepts developed by Freud and his immediate circle of followers as psychoanalysis got started in Vienna more than a century ago. So many concepts that have turned out not to really have any clear correlative in reality.
Right.
Repression is certainly one of those.
Right.
Even the defense mechanisms as conceived by Freud aren't all of them demonstrable as being there, as working, as being in the repertoire of human beings trying to handle the problems of their lives. And then when it comes to the Oedipus complex and the stages of development, it's a charming or a frightening fantasy which has had tremendous influence, and if you believe it to be true, it has a consequence for how you handle your life.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think Freud was a, if we think of
Freud
as
a great creative artist.
Yes, if we think of him as a philosopher, a creative thinker, I think he was brilliant, but he was certainly no scientist.
Then you've got the extra question of whether the psychotherapy invented and elaborated by Freud is worth the investment.
I would say no. I'd say there are much better ways to spend your money if you're looking for psychological health.
Rather than $150 an hour for 4 hours a week for
right.
8 or 10 years.
Right.
591-7200 is our phone number. But we also, of course, are open for email from wherever you are hearing this program. If you're listening on the internet at some great distance elsewhere in the world and want to join us via email, that email address is extension 720 at tribune.com. extension 720 as one word at tribune, tribune.com, or the aforementioned 591-7200. Susan, you ready for a call?
Sure.
Here we go. This is the first one up. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening. I have read Dr. Clancy's book in which he says that the Hill case is the template for all following abduction cases. And I expected that she'd sharply analyze the book about it, John Fuller's The Interrupted Journey, so as to have as many parallels as possible. But instead, I found that she so completely misrepresents the statements and even the form of the book that I think that I can't even say that it's intellectually dishonest. I think there has to be some sort of psychological explanation for this, some sort of scotoma to cover.
Let's not deal in that sort of accusation. Let's make your case if you want to. Where does she misinterpret and misreport what's in the book about Barney and Betty Hill?
Well, for example, she says that it is inexplicable that Fuller would have his own version of the story and then have the hypnotic transcripts, which are different. But Fuller's book actually gives the original memory, conscious memory, of a close encounter of the third kind. And then the subsequent events in the life of Betty and Barney Hill, which led up to the hypnotic regression, which got a memory, true or not, of actually being abducted by the occupants which they saw.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing.
Let's deal with that one thing, shall we, Susan?
Yeah, I'm a little unclear as to what precisely this thing is.
I'm afraid I am too. Okay. Sir, may I ask you, are you a practitioner in one of the related professions?
Hmm?
Are you a practitioner in one of the related professions?
You mean a professional psychiatrist or something?
Or something like that, yes.
No.
Yeah. Well, I don't quite know. There wasn't too much coherence in what you had to say. Let's make one more try, but time is rather limited.
What I'm saying is that she said that Fuller had two different stories and they contradicted each other. They don't. One story was consciously remembered and it was a close encounter of the third kind. The second story was this close encounter of the third kind plus the subsequent abduction, which he makes it look like there was a contradiction. There wasn't.
Okay, no. Susan, can you respond to that?
I wish I had the book in front of me because we could sit down and discuss the page. I don't think there was a contradiction so much. I think my main point in bringing up the Betty and Barney was that what's interesting about their story is they saw something in 1961 and then they elaborated on what they saw during their hypnosis sessions, and then it was written up as a book.
And then Betty Hill elaborated on it for the next 20 years.
Yes.
I met her once at a sort of parapsychological convention here in Chicago.
Yeah, I met her too up in New Hampshire. So
I think she's finally passed on, has she? Or
yes.
Maybe not. But she was the sort of the central figure at meetings of that sort for the following 20 years.
Yeah.
And made a pretty good living at it. So I'm sure that she was not faking it. I'm sure that she had inner conviction that all of this had really happened.
No, I think like almost all of the abductees I interviewed, I think that she really believed the memories that she retrieved. Yeah. And
our phone number is 591-7200. One or two lines are now available. If you've been trying to reach us, we've been necessarily screening the calls. Not everybody passes muster, but I'm sure you will if you make a try again. 591-7200. If you want to join us, move quickly, and you may well get through. And if you don't, the proper strategy, of course, is to call again right after we've said goodnight to somebody else. And if you want to join us by email, that's extension 720 at tribune.com. We return to Susan Clancy and to your calls and or emails after this. Our guest tonight is Susan Clancy, who's talking with us from Boston tonight. She is a postdoctoral fellow in psychology at Harvard University and the author of the new book, Abducted, How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens. That is published by Harvard University Press. 591-7200 is our number. And if you want to reach us by email, that's extension 720 at tribune.com. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. Dr.
Yes, sir.
Clancy. Good to talk to you after a number of years here. I was just curious, what, if anything, can be gleaned from the hypnosis or hypnosis regression of some of the folks that claim that they've been abducted? And, you know, is that type of research or that type of analysis useful at all in the type of work that Dr. Clancy's done?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. You mean hypnosis in general?
Hypnosis in general, right.
Yeah. Hypnosis, if you're using it to retrieve memories or fill in details of fuzzy memories you have, is not a good idea. Not only will it probably not help you retrieve memories, you are in danger of creating false memories. However, hypnosis has been successfully used in other types of therapeutic situations, like pain reduction or helping people quit smoking, et cetera. I'm sure, you know, Milt Rosenberg can tell us about how hypnosis can be used in a positive way. But in terms of memories and trying to recover memories or retrieve fuzzy memories, just don't do it.
You know, it's worth pointing out that hypnosis has sometimes been used incorrectly, to be sure, in the investigation of great public mysteries. For example, Jim Garrison down in New Orleans, when he opened up his own investigation of the Kennedy assassination, used hypnosis, supposedly, on some people to recover their memory of whatever he had the hypnotist implant in them, whether willfully or otherwise. You know, some of his evidence actually was hypnotic, and that alone was reason to throw the whole thing out.
Yeah.
But, there are some therapeutic uses for hypnosis. What hypnosis really is in itself a researchable and difficult question. There was a fellow who was up at Harvard before you were there, Susan, whom I knew, Martin Orne. Do you know his work at all?
Oh, you know, I worked with Martin Orne.
You did?
Yes, in 1991 and 92 at the Unit for Experimental Psychiatry in Philadelphia.
Oh, down there. Well, of course.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell our listeners something about what Orne achieved by way of understanding the nature of hypnosis itself?
Well, I mean, I think he was one of the foremost hypnosis researchers. I think he contributed a lot to our understanding of hypnosis. But when I was working with him, we were working with children who had sickle cell anemia, and we were using hypnosis to reduce the pain that's associated with that disorder.
Uh-huh.
And it was actually very effective for some of these kids.
Martin, of course, was an MD as well as a PhD, a psychiatrist and psychologist.
Yeah.
Well, we thank the caller, and let's go directly to another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Hello. My question is, I understand a lot of the research took place regarding the regressive memories and hypnosis, but I was wondering if there was any other kind of research that was done that didn't involve regression, that dealt with more people that didn't have these memories after hypnosis, as well as people that claim that they were physically harmed and they feel that they have physical proof through the supposed abductions.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. A lot of people will say to me, I have memories of being abducted by aliens, but I never underwent hypnosis. I didn't seek out an abduction researcher to perform hypnosis. But I think it's important to realize that what hypnosis is doing is it's luring you into a sort of suggestible state. You're relaxed, your normal reality constraints are down, and in a state like that, you're very prone to confuse things that you imagine or that you worry about with things that actually happen to you. And you don't need hypnosis to have that happen. Some people have it happen after too many martinis. Some people are just particularly fantasy prone, and when they're relaxed and vegging out and watching TV, it can happen. Other people recovered their memories during massages or intense yoga sessions. So I don't think you need to go into hypnosis to recover memories of alien abduction experiences. It's just any state in which you're intensely relaxed and your normal reality constraints are down and you're imagining something that you worry about or somebody suggesting to you something that might have happened. So
okay.
That's an important point I want to stress. You don't need formal hypnosis.
But did anyone bring forth any kind of evidence of any kind of physical evidence
Yes.
that they felt they suffered?
Yes. I actually have lots of pictures that research subjects sent me about the scoop marks on their back or the strange moles they have. But the problem with that evidence is it's not unambiguous. I mean, it certainly is interesting. It's a mark on the body. But whether you could say that it's extraterrestrial in nature, no. It's what we consider kind of ambiguous evidence. So it does exist, but it's not proof that aliens were abducting these people.
Okay.
Does
very
that
good.
Help?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we thank you, ma'am. Glad to have had you. We go directly back to the phones. I see now there are some lines available again. If you were trying to reach us, do make another quick try, and you may well get through. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. I have a comment and then a question. The comment is about sleep paralysis. I want to mention, because I think it's relevant to your discussion, that I can vouch for it. And I would say it's probably less scary when it happens during the day, because the reason it's confusing is that although you can't move a muscle, the sensory input is largely unmodified.
That's
but
right.
Largely is an important word here, because what happened was that I was in the back seat of the car with my parents, and I was aware of an ache in my neck because my head, of course, had fallen down on my chest. However, I couldn't move my head, no matter how much willpower I summoned up. So I was in sleep paralysis, but I was still aware of the green interior of the car and the light coming through the windows. However, the radio program on the car radio was altered in my sleep state. And I know that it was altered because the program that I heard out of my past is not one that my parents would have wanted to listen to. And when I came fully awake, I found that I could move my head and things were back to normal. And I realized that I had been sleep paralyzed. And so if a person is lying in bed at night and they can't move a muscle and then a moonbeam comes through the window and the mind alters it a little bit, I can see how they might alter that into a UFO abduction. But that leads to my question. If we go from the one extreme of saying, well, yes, this does happen to me, you're not entitled to question it, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
But what about the other extreme of saying, no, it could never happen? Isn't that equally unfalsifiable? I agree with you that the stance of probably not is probably safer, because
right.
It certainly, if something does become provable, it'll be incontrovertible. And it's better to be skeptical than gullible. But how do we avoid the other unfalsifiable error of saying never?
Excellent question. Excellent. And in fact, I want to say, defend myself perhaps. In the book, I make it very clear that I can't falsify somebody's proposition that aliens are abducting them.
No,
and I say that in the book.
Fair-minded.
Yeah, I say that ultimately you're entitled to your own opinion. You have personal access to data that I don't have access to, which is your experiences, and it's possible that you were abducted by aliens. I can't disprove that. All I can say is that a more parsimonious explanation, one that's a little more probabilistic, is that you weren't abducted by aliens, and that in fact, you know, due to a number of factors, you've created false memories. So.
Could I raise another question? Why do people assume, in the light of the alien abduction possibility, why do they tend to assume that the alien activities will tend to be malevolent, or is that not always assumed?
No, it's not always assumed, actually. That's another excellent question. One of the things that I cover in the book that I found very important about the research is that although the initial experiences are quite nightmarish and terrifying and painful and scary, afterwards, the subjects report for the most part that they are happy they were abducted, that because they were abducted, they have a sense that there's something bigger than them out in the world, that they have a new sense of spirituality and meaning. They report that the aliens were there to perhaps help out humankind or communicate some kind of information, etc. So
I'm glad they messed with my internal organs.
Well, some of them say that, actually. It was for a higher purpose, and
you know,
I'm willing to sacrifice.
There is something quite pleasantly salacious about the turn that the alien abduction story has taken in the last decade or so. That is, that their ultimate purpose attributed to them is to engage in intergalactic miscegenation and produce a new race of superior beings who are half Andromedan or whatever, and half human.
The hybrid, yeah.
The hybrid, yeah. So that the pattern that the memory takes now often involves, doesn't it?
And wouldn't it be great if I participated in such a superior evolutionary step? Boy, that's good for my ego, isn't it?
You have some people.
Nice to be chosen. I wish it would happen to me.
Susan, you have some people that you interviewed who, in fact, give you memories of their sort of intergalactic coital adventure.
Oh, yes. In detail, yeah.
Yeah. There's one fellow who describes a rather sylph-like alien whom he much enjoyed.
There was a lot of sex with attractive sylph-like alien females. Yeah.
Yeah, there you are. Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thanks for the dialogue.
Here's an email I want to read to you. Dear Milt and guest, over the years I have learned the real truth about Freud by listening to your show. But when I talk to other scientifically minded people in those terms, they are shocked that I will hold such a view. It seems there are still a huge number of people in the scientific community who think that whatever Freud preached was scientific and still holds value.
Yes.
I want to know from both of you the status of Freud among the psychological and psychiatric academic and practicing community. I realize it is a broad question, but if you could address it, that will be very useful. Do it indeed, Susan. Address that.
Well, Let me see if I can do that. I would say among the researchers, so people that do scientific research, the opinion is that Freud was no scientist and he had interesting ideas, but most of them should be relegated to the psychiatric folklore category. But I think for psychologists that are practicing, so not the academic psychologists, but the ones that are in private practice and who are really focused on trying to help their patients, for those psychologists and psychiatrists, Freud is very much alive and well, and the idea of repression continues to thrive as a way of understanding people's psychological distress.
Yeah. There's a large body of critical literature. One can mention a number of people their work can be pursued if you just Google them on the internet. Well known is Fred Crews, C-R-E-W-S, to be sure, a professor of English. It was once a convinced Freudian and a leader of sort of the Freudian school in literary criticism, but lost the faith and began to look at it because of especially the false memory of sexual abuse problem.
Right.
And has done very important work reviewing all the history of psychoanalysis. Frank Sulloway did a book years ago titled Freud, Biologist of the Mind, I think, which was quite positive towards Freud. He's a historian of science person, but the closer he looked into Freudianism, and the more he persisted even after the publication of that book, the more he tended to lose the faith and became very, very critical. Now, he drew heavily on the work of Adolf Grunbaum, who is a philosopher of science, I believe at the University of Pittsburgh, who has given Freud a properly hard reanalysis. And it goes way back to Vienna. Karl Krauss, who was one of the great literary figures of Vienna, at the same time Freud was in practice, wrote very cynically about the whole Freudian mélange even back then. Somebody else associated with Harvard, I think he was. Do you know the name of J. Allen Hobson?
Oh, yes.
Wasn't he a psychiatrist at Harvard? Or
You know what? That's embarrassing. I don't think he was a psychiatrist. Isn't he a... Oh, my gosh.
I think he's a psychiatrist.
Okay.
Who also did research disconfirming particularly the notion of repression and of the so-called unconscious mind. I think psychoanalysis generally has found itself in a state of crisis. Lots of psychiatrists have lost their faith and their belief in it. And it is no longer the best way to become a high-ranking psychiatrist, to go get yourself a training analysis for 7 or 8 years and begin to practice that rather strange art.
That is the case for sure. You're right.
All right. We are going to pause once again for the usual reasons, then directly back to the phones and to the email. If you want to reach us by phone, the number 591-7200. Some lines are available again. The email has infinite capacity, and that address is extension720@tribune.com. And we return, in turn, to Susan Clancy. We've been drawing from her very valuable new book, and utterly readable as well, Abducted, How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens. Harvard University Press, the publishers. And if you want to order it instantly, and you can, your computer is handy, you can just go to your computer and go to our website. That is wgnradio.com, and click on my name, which takes you to the subsite for this program. And there, among the many things available, is our program schedule. And if you scroll down to the very last night for October, you will find a picture of the cover of this book. And if you click on that, you are in the hands of Barnes & Noble, who will sell the book to you for a significant reduction in price. 591-7200 is the number. By the way, if you go to our site, you can also click on Milt's File, our regular blog, and we've got some new items up tonight, which should be of considerable interest. You don't have to do that via the WGN website. You can just go directly to miltsfile.com, and that will take you to our regular blog. And we go to the next caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to report a peculiar event that may have some bearing on Barney and Betty.
All right.
My ex-wife occasionally talked in her sleep, and I could, on a couple occasions, talk to her while she was sleeping and question her. She wasn't always coherent, but it did happen. Now, one morning, I woke up and had a a memory of the events that just occurred in my sleep, and I recalled that my wife and I were carrying on a conversation in our sleep. And I didn't remember the content of it, but conceivably, a couple could share a dream or share a hallucination and be completely unaware of the fact that, that it had occurred. I don't know if this applies to Barney and Betty, but it seems possible.
Well, I think that's a very interesting anecdote you just shared with us. And if you were prone to suspect you might have been abducted by aliens, that might become one of the experiences that you would elaborate on during hypnosis or some kind of quasi-hypnotic technique with an abduction researcher, where he would say, I want you to go back to that night. You were having the conversation with your wife. Do you remember what you were talking about? Do you remember if anybody else was in the room with you, et cetera, et cetera? So, yeah, I think that that's very interesting, and something like that could very easily become the seed of a full-blown abduction memory later on.
And it could be shared by both members of the
exactly.
couple.
Exactly. And then people would say it's two of us that had the memory, and that makes it even more credible.
So. Or we might not even have the memory, but it would come out under hypnosis.
That's exactly right.
Just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, no,
well,
that's fascinating.
It's a very valuable contribution. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Good night.
Good night.
Before we go back to the phones, indulge me, if you would, Susan, since we couldn't talk before the program because you're not in the studio, we're talking to you on ISDN line, I didn't get a chance to ask you, have you had any significant contact within your own department of psychology at the, Harvard with the social psychology people?
You know... No, actually, well, I mean, who, Jerry Kagan was he's more developmental. No, I would say no.
Do you know Herb Kelman?
I knew Herb Kelman. I took some classes with him, but not any sort of personal contact.
Or Roger Brown?
No.
That was before your time, I think.
Yes, I think he, when I got there, he had just retired.
Yeah. The reason I ask, I'm a social psychologist, and
yeah.
It does seem to me, of course, that... quite a very relevant additional question here is what conditions foster the spread of such social mythology?
Right.
How does alien abduction gain such wide provenance so quickly? It
right.
must have something to do with the fit between the content of that myth and aspects of our present life, our present concern. Do you have any thoughts along those lines?
Well, I'm sort of stepping outside my bailiwick with that question. It's certainly something I've thought about, but I'm not a social psychologist, and I feel a little uncomfortable speculating. I do think, though, that we're in a time now where people are feeling nervous. Maybe it has to do with terrorism or, I don't know, instability in the world, et cetera. And I think there are a lot of people that seem to be looking for some kind of spiritual meaning in their life. And I think this is, in a sense, a kind of religion for a scientific age. I mean, we're in an age where science prevails, and this is kind of like some kind of hybrid, I think, between traditional religion and a sort of technological age. And I think it's just meeting people's needs right now.
You know, one figure who had a great deal to do with getting this whole thing started, as well as, of course, ufology generally, used to be a guest on this program. Because he was, in the last years of his life, a professor of astronomy at Northwestern University.
Uh-huh.
I speak of Alan Hynek. You know that name.
Yes, yes.
And Alan, I would often argue with him, both on the air and off. He's a very charming and pleasant fellow. And I would often just really say to him, as if I were shaking him by the shoulders, though I wasn't shaking him, how can you do this? I mean, you're a scientist. You know scientific method. Why do you give so much credence to all of these... obviously fanciful experiences of direct sightings of UFOs when you know that there are alternative explanations.
Right.
And Alan, I must say now, he's long since gone to his rewards, which I hope are considerable in another sphere, but it was very clear that he was getting a lot of gratification from the public attention. that he had never had before, but now he had, with his center, which was really just, you know, his own office, his center up at Northwestern for whatever he called it. For the, then you'll remember, of course, his book, what is it? What kind of experiences of the third kind? Strange Experiences of the Third Kind.
Okay.
Was made, but that title, I believe, was used for a fine UFO film. That is a very effective one. Who did that one?
Are you talking about Close Encounters?
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yes,
exactly.
Steven Spielberg.
That's a Spielberg film. Yeah. And Close Encounters of the Third Kind gave us indeed the imagery of the aliens, didn't it?
Well, he used, maybe this is too much detail, but anyway, Steven Spielberg apparently used the sketch
of the hills, yeah.
Barney Hill gave,
right,
during hypnosis, which alien abduction researchers then link back to an episode of The Outer Limits called, yeah, The Bolero Shield,
uh-huh,
which Barney Hill had seen 12 days before his hypnosis session.
A good question to those who report their alien abduction experiences is, how come you all, if you get 100 of them in a room, then confront them, how come that all of you seem to see the same creatures in exactly the same way? Are we being visited from only one planet with all that vast universe out there? Or is that the way extraterrestrial life always evolves? Little creatures, gray or green, with vast eyes and no noses, and wraparound eyes, as you say.
And big heads.
And very, very big heads. Macrocephalics. Yeah.
Although I think one point I'd like to make, although you didn't really ask about it specifically,
yeah,
is people who believe in alien abduction always say to me, well, if it's not happening, why does everybody say the same thing?
Exactly.
Why,
yeah,
do so many people all over the country say the same thing? And I find it an interesting comment, because while the general plot is the same, so an extraterrestrial creature came down and took me from my bedroom or car for sexual and medical purposes, the details of the story, you know, the exact cast of characters, the costume, the they differ widely depending on who you're talking to. So what the aliens are actually wearing, whether it's orange jumpsuits or no clothes at all or black hooded tracksuits,
mm-hmm,
you know, how many fingers they have, what color they are exactly, what types of medical devices are implanted or used, they all differ quite dramatically between people. So I don't really know how similar these accounts are. They don't seem that similar to me.
Here's an email I want to read to you. The TV show The X-Files was wildly popular. Then science fiction shows languished. They are currently back in full force on network TV.
Yeah.
All three major networks have an invasion-themed program broadcast in prime time.
Yeah,
are right. You seeing an uptick in the abduction invasion claims?
You know, I don't know, because I am not collecting any more data on this topic right,
mm-hmm,
now. So there are certainly organizations that research this that would be able to answer that question. I don't know. I think the question I'm interested in is, why are we seeing this increase in TV shows? You know, the alien abduction phenomena has been with us for the last 30 years. I would think it would be ready to die out now. And instead of dying out, we're now seeing we're seeing an even greater cultural increase in interest or
something. Any changes in the basic story this time around?
I will have to wait and see. I mean, I don't know. I collected this data over the last six,
yeah,
years. What I found is in the book. It's sort of been consistent for the last 30, 40 years, what people are saying. Is it going to change over the next 10 or 20 years? I assume so. That seems to be what generally happens, but I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see.
What's happened in the UFO alien abductee community with regard to their response to you since the book appeared, or the earlier articles and the magazine articles about you?
I just have to say that I do not have the thick skin required, I think, to,
yeah,
be in this area. I mean, I was in the childhood sexual abuse area beforehand, and I'm actually returning to that now with my second book, That Is My Home. And I thought that that was politically volatile. But if you could see my email, I mean, my blood pressure just goes up checking my inbox.
Tell me about it. What's the typical?
People are just angry.
What are they saying?
I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm an idiot, or I'm an egotistical narcissist, yeah, or I'm just stupid, or I mean, it just goes on and on. People are just very, very angry. If you challenge their beliefs they hold near and dear to them, you're going to pay the price for that. There are consequences.
So much condemnation. What degree of commendation to balance it?
Well, the commendation there, I would say it's about 20% commendation and about 80% condemnation.
Yeah.
But the intensity of the condemnation is what's surprising to me. I mean, I knew people wouldn't be happy if they believed in alien abductions, but I did not anticipate how angry this would make people.
Yeah, that is sad. And it can be rather demanding and rather onerous for somebody at the receiving end, to be sure.
I think I need to start drinking more or something. I don't know. But, I would just like to say, since I'm on the radio, I would like to say that, as I stress in the book, I really can't disprove your claims. You know, I think you have the right to believe what you want if you think you were abducted by aliens. And, you know, I can't. It may be true, and no one will be happier than me if it turns out that aliens actually do exist. But right now, I'm allowed to have my opinion too.
You also say in this book
you
also say in this book that most of these people are really quite likable people.
They really are. I still, you know, for a while I stayed in contact with them. I got Christmas cards. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really enjoyed my time spent interviewing in this community.
But no Christmas cards from Mars.
No, I have not. I have no telephone calls, no Christmas cards.
We've got a last round of commercials coming. Then we will return to Susan Clancy and one or two more phone calls after this. And we return to Susan Clancy. Susan, what are your plans for in the next few years? Are you going back to Nicaragua, or are you on a new operation?
Yes, I'm going back to Nicaragua, and I'm actually in the throes of writing my second book, which is writing up the sexual abuse research.
Yes.
And it's actually about repression and childhood sexual abuse in the United States. So I'm going to be working on that for the next year, and then we will take it from there.
Your ultimate intention is to remain academic and do that in the States, I gather.
My ultimate intention is to remain academic, probably do it in the States, but just get myself into a position where I can be disseminating scientific research down to the general public. I mean, that's my ultimate goal. And, you know, I'm trying to do it through the books, trying to make science accessible, and I would like to continue working on that.
Well, this first book is excellent reading. I should tell all of our listeners that the book Abducted is written for the general reader, and it's entertainingly done in fine style, and yet at the same time obviously quite responsibly done, in that it makes clear the nature of the research upon which the argument is based. 591-7200 is our number. Let's work in a few more quick phone calls. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Hi.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. I might have misunderstood you earlier, but I thought that Dr. Clancy and the other gentleman you were speaking with said there's no such thing as repressed memory, but there's lost memories. What's the difference?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Yeah. Okay, how do I answer that quickly? Okay, it's a great question. Oh. Here's the thing. People can forget childhood sexual abuse experiences. Let's just keep it within the context of the childhood sexual abuse.
Well, that's what happened with my cousin, supposedly.
Yeah,
and she killed herself over this.
Over, because when she remembered it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But what happens is many psychologists assume that if you forgot your childhood sexual abuse memories, it's because you repressed it. So some unconscious automatic defense mechanism set in because the memory was so traumatic you couldn't handle it. So your unconscious banished it into the recesses of your brain, okay? But memory researchers would say, you know, you could have just forgotten it in the way that you forget any other experience that you try not to think about or that maybe you didn't understand at the time, et cetera, and you don't need to evoke this kind of crazy concept of repression. So
it's just a matter of semantics.
I mean, actually, it's so funny. It's like for the perspective of the general population, they probably don't care whether it's repression or just normal forgetting. But you have all these memory researchers that are going crazy with each other over how best to understand how these memories are actually forgotten.
I would just think if your father abused you as a child, that wouldn't be something you'd forget. You know?
You know what, though? I agree, and I think most people think that. But if you look at the data, the average age that kids are sexually abused is like 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. What generally happens to them is that they're touched or molested by somebody they know and trust. And most victims say they just didn't understand what happened until later on. They knew it was weird. They knew it was unpleasant. They knew they weren't supposed to tell anyone. But it's only later on in life that they realize, oh, my God, that was clearly sexual in nature and wrong. Does that make sense?
I guess it does. You know, I mean, my cousin was married, had children in her 40s, and, you know, and all of a sudden all this came out, you know.
Well, however, ma'am, you can't be sure that what came out was veridical, that it really reflected what had actually happened.
Right, exactly. I mean, her father denied it, you know, till his dying day.
He may have been truthfully denied.
Well, mm-hmm. What came, you know, a way to determine whether it was veridical or not, if what came out is highly traumatic, so it involved force, was incredibly painful, as in rape experiences, it's highly unlikely that those would ever be forgotten.
Uh-huh.
So if that's what came out after a psychotherapy session or something, it's a chance that that was a false memory. But if what comes out is, I was touched, I didn't understand it, etc., then it probably was just forgotten or not thought about for many, many years.
Okay, yeah, that sounds more like happened. Yeah.
Interesting.
I was just very curious about the, you know, the difference between lost and repressed.
It's excellent, excellent question.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's a very interesting show. I've never listened to you before, but it's very interesting.
It's amazing that you haven't developed a habit before. Now that you've found us, don't go away.
Normally, I'm at work at this time.
I see.
All right, well, thank you. And happy Halloween.
Yes, indeed. When all those strange spirits come out. Indeed, there are some people who are these days sounding a certain amount of concern about whether Halloween is really, and the way we celebrate it, is all that good for our kids or even for our society. Yeah, got any views on that?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I don't know. My happiest childhood memories are wearing my witch costume and going around and getting candy. So
that's all right,
I don't know.
That's all right. I understand that you are shortly to be a mother. Is that for the first time?
No, actually, I just had my third child 2 weeks ago.
Oh, you've had a child?
Yes.
I was told that you were still
getting
ready for
it. Well, at the time you contacted me about the show,
I was
getting ready for it. But now I've had my third. Yes.
What are they?
Three girls.
All girls?
All girls.
One is brand new. How old are the other two?
I got a 4-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 2-week-old. That's so beautiful. I don't sleep much.
That is lovely. Well, I thank you very much for joining us tonight. And once again, the book by Susan Clancy that we've been drawing from is Abducted, How People Come to Believe They Were Kidnapped by Aliens.